Okay, Hare Krishna. Good morning, everybody. Welcome to Radhakala Chandi Srimad Bhagavatam class. Today is Thursday. We are June 8th. And we have our beloved spiritual master, Tamal Krishna Goswami's Vyas Puja celebration this Saturday. So you're all cordially invited. And if for some reason you can't make it and you find yourself in New York, Saturday's also the New York Rath Yatra. So this is a melody I learned in Vrindavan. Jai Radha Madhava Jai Kunja Bihane. That's it. Perfect. Jai Radha Madhava Jai Kunja Bihari. Chana Valabhava Jai Giri Vadadhare Jai Giri Vadavohare. Jana Valabhava Jaya Giri Vadar Hare Jaya Giri Vadar Hare. Sahanana prajajananjana yasurnandana prajajananjana jaya Jamuratira Vanachadi Jayakum Chabihan Jaya Radha Madhava Jaya Nityalila Pravishnam Vishnupad Astu Tirtha Shri Shimada Zvangris. Shishi Radha Kalachanji Ki Gopravakthavrinda Ki Nitai Gopravamanandi. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the lotus feet of Shishi Guru and Gauranga. All glories to you, Srila Prabhupada. Stime Dalai Shimati Tamal Krishna Goswami Tanamani. Good morning. Thank you for coming. Hare Krishna. So, and that was very good on the cartels. Thanks. You're getting it. So this morning, we're reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, 11th canto, chapter 15. We're beginning with text number 10. This chapter is entitled, Description of Mystic Yoga Perfections. So please repeat. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. So I'm going to read the Sanskrit that's written on the board here. You can chant along with me if you like. So I'll read it word for word so you can kind of get the words here. So it goes Buddha, then Shukshmatami. Shukshma. Buddha Shukshma means of subtle elements. And then Atmani means in the soul. So Buddha Shukshatmani. Mayi, tan, matram, darayan, mana, ani manam, avapnoti, tan, matro, pakshako, mama. So I'll just read it slowly. You can chant along. It goes, Buddha Shukshmatmini Mayi. Yeah, that Atmani and Shukshma joined together, so the A is shared. So it's kind of like Buddha Shukshatmani. Yeah, that's it. Mayi. That's how it fits it all together in the meter. Then Tan Matram Darayan Mana. Tan Matram Darayan Mana. That's it. Animanam Avapnoti. Tan Matro Pakshako Mama. That's it. Yeah, that's it. Okay, I'm going to do it one more time. Buddha Shukshatmani Mahaye. Tan Mantram Darayan Mana. Animanam Avapnoti. Tan Matro Pakshako Mama. Would any of you like to try it? Try saying it? Want to try it? Go ahead, just give it a try, don't worry. I still make some mistakes after years of it. Buddha, yes. Oh, you want to just go ahead, say the whole thing all the way through. That's fine. Pakshako Mama. And what about you, sir? Would you like to try? No? Okay, no problem. All right, here's the word for word meetings. Buddha Shukshma, of the subtle elements. Atmani means in the soul. Mayi, in me. Tat Matram, on the subtle elemental forms. On the subtle elemental forms of perception. Darayet, one should concentrate. Mana, the mind. Animanam, the mystic perfection called anima. Avapnoti, obtains. Tat matra, in the subtle elements. Upasaka, the worshipper. And mama, my. Okay, translation and purport by the loving disciples of Srila Prabhupada. One who worships me in my atomic form, pervading all subtle elements, fixing his mind on that alone, obtains the mystic perfection called anima. So please repeat. One who worships me in my atomic form, pervading all subtle elements, fixing his mind on that alone, obtains the mystic perfection called anima. Purport. Anima refers to the mystic ability to make oneself smaller than the smallest, and thus able to enter within anything. The Supreme Personality of Godhead is within the atoms and atomic particles, and one who perfectly fixes his mind in that subtle atomic form of the Lord acquires the mystic potency called anima, by which one can enter within even the most dense matter, such as stone. Om Gnata Manandasya Gananjana Shalakaya Chakshusamilyatam Jaina Tasmai Shri Guruve Nama Shri Chaitanya Manobhistam Stapitam Jaina Bhutale Swayam Rupa Kadamayam Tadati Swapadantikam. So, good morning again. Welcome. In our class today, one of the three main expressions of the Personality of Godhead is being described here, known as Paramatma. According to the Vedas, there were three primary manifestations of God that are interacting with us and that exist. There's a beautiful verse. It goes, Brahmeti Paramameti Bhagavaniti Shabdate. And what this verse means is that, first of all, everything is the energy of the Supreme. Right, we've talked about it before. But basically, Krishna, he describes that if we look at the necessities of life, like the air we breathe, it's so nice to breathe. Well, we know that there's no company that's manufacturing that air. You see, or the sunshine, right? Without the sun, we'd be frozen, we'd be dead. Right? Xerox is not producing the sunshine. You see? And that goes for everything. You know, the food that we eat, it's coming from the earth, from the rain, from the sun. The wood we're using for our furniture, the metal we're using for our electronics and our vehicles. The simple ability to see, to speak, to think. All of this energy is coming to us by the arrangement of a higher transcendental power, far beyond human capability to reproduce. And this energy is, not only is it maintaining us, but it's also controlling us, and it's nurturing us. You see? Srila Prabhupada made the joke that, you know, you can go out there and look up at the sun, you won't see a little price tag up there. In fact, in earlier days, practically everything was free. Even when I was a kid, I don't even remember ever paying for food. What to speak of water? There was no question of buying water. And like I remember, you know, we would eat at home or go to a neighbor's house and their mother would be feeding us, or go to a relative's home and they'd be feeding us. You see, the church, the food was free at the church. I mean, it was like that, you see. And in fact, years back, in 1981, I went to the Fijian Islands. Some of the devotees here are from Fiji. And you guys have all seen that Fiji water, right? So it's a group of about 250 islands in the South Pacific. It's a beautiful place. The main island is called Latoka. And it has a mountain range, which is very unique. And the mountains have a natural springs that come down and form rivers. And the rivers are crystal clear. Even the ocean water in that area is crystal clear. You can see, you can go on a boat, or you can just stand on the shore, go swimming out a little bit, and you can see the bottom of the ocean. The water is just pristine, bluish green, and transparent. I remember a particular river. One of my godbrothers has a sugarcane farm, and his farm, it bordered this river. The river came down from the mountains, and the river was about as wide as this temple room, and maybe 10 feet deep. But you could see the bottom of the river. The water was pristine clear. You could go there and drink the water. And what was really unique is on both sides of this river, for as far as you could see, these enormous mango trees grew. The local people had planted them there from years ago. And all of the local people from the islands, all the surrounding islands, come there and just collect the mangoes for free. Huge mangoes. Like, some of the mangoes were like the size of a football. You know? And just incredibly fragrant. And the trees produce so many mangoes that even the local people couldn't eat them all. And if you go there, you just find dozens of mangoes just laying on the ground or in the tree just ready to be picked. And not only that, there were wild pineapples growing, wild banana trees growing, avocado trees grow wild. Practically everything you need to live was being provided naturally. You can even go there and see, like, the local Fijian women and Indian women. They'll come out in the morning, like, wearing these kind of, like, it's like a, it's called a lungi. It's like a Zulu type of a traditional outfit with a wraparound skirt and a blouse. And then they'll have these kind of turbans. We were talking about it the other day. Yeah, and they carry these baskets, handmade baskets, large baskets, and they just go into the surrounding forest and just collect everything they need for the day to eat. In fact, there was one couple, my spiritual master, he asked me to go from village to village and distribute books. And many of the villages that I went to, they didn't even have a road. Nobody even had a car. You go to the village on a dirt path, walking out there. It's so peaceful. And flowers and vegetables and fruits just growing wild all around you. And beautiful exotic types of birds and parrots, you know, you could hear them chirping. There was no, you know, highway noises and all of that, you know. And what was really interesting is there was one particular couple, and this couple had 25 children. And they just had a simple, like you were describing me from the Republic of, how do you say it, Republic? The Dominican Republic, right? From the islands there. They use this corrugated metal, and they actually build like the framework of these reasonably nice, I don't know what you want to call them, huts, but they're big. But they would build it, the frame, out of bamboo, and have like a raised dirt floor, maybe 2 feet off the ground, bamboo structure, corrugated metal, and then they put this woven mat down as a flooring, and they have like mustard oil lamps. They have these lamps that hang from chains. You see this in India too, in the villages. I lived in one village in India, and in a hut like that, it was entirely made of grass, woven mats, and a grass roof. It didn't even have corrugated metal, and it was so healthy and very cool, refreshing. At night, when we were living in this hut in India, what we would do is we'd burn frankincense, and the frankincense would drive mosquitoes out of the hut, and then we would put up mosquito nets, these kind of like rectangular mosquito nets that were a little bit larger than a sleeping area, and just sleep in there. And you feel great. I mean, really great. You know, it's like you're sleeping on the earth. You just get so rejuvenated from living like that. Hare Krishna, good morning. And, yeah, so this family, they had 25 children, and their home, this is in Fiji, in one of the villages, and they had a couple of cows for milk. They lived right on the riverside, which was pristine water and they had a beautiful garden area, and they just water from the garden. And then there were the local trees and wild vegetables and things that grew there. And they were able to sustain 25 kids like it was nothing. They weren't stressed. They weren't, you know, fighting over who's going to change diapers or anything like that, you know. I mean, and it was just beautiful. And I saw that again and again. And I also saw that there weren't these autonomous families, but there were extended families. So, like, say there was a couple with their kids, but then their mom, their grandmother, their aunts, their uncles, their brothers, their sisters, all their kids. You know, they either lived in a complex that was large, you know, or they kind of build them in like a rectangular shapes where they have rooms. They have a porch that goes around the outside of it, and then they have a courtyard on the inside, and where the kids could play and stuff and be, you know, without being supervised very, very much. And it was really nice. Really nice. And the extended family too, I thought, was a big advantage, because I saw like young guys going out and working on these farm projects with their parent, with their father, you know, or uncle. Thanks for coming in. Have a great day. All right, well. And, but the point I'm making is that actually nature is arranged by Krishna to provide everything we need to be happy and healthy. It's only we that falsely claim things to be our own, and we, you know, manipulate and exploit each other with these, you know, so-called possessions. But in fact, Krishna is really, by the arrangement of nature, providing everything. My wife's father, he passed away now, but he was telling me when he was about 20 years old, so let's say right now he would be about 83. So 63 years ago, he left India and he went to Singapore, and he told me he went on a boat, you know, a ship, wooden ship, a sail ship. And he told me there were no passports or anything. He said he paid like $3 to take the ship from India to Singapore, so from India to Malaysia. And he said all of his meals were provided. And then you just get down off the ship and you can just find a job, you know, go to any company that was there. You know, Singapore was a shipping port. So, you know, he went and he actually got employed by the police department of Singapore. And he said, but you could just, you know, claim land. Even here in America, they had the, you know, settlers that came here. Even like there's a very famous ranch in South Texas called the King Ranch. Even the Ford Motor Corporation, they adopted this name for one of their trucks, King Ranch edition. But the King Ranch, it's like 1 million acres, and it was this family that came here and just marked off that land and claimed it for themselves. The government allowed people to do that at that time, you know. So Brahmeti. So Brahman realization means that to understand that everything is Krishna's energy, and even our own abilities are Krishna's energy. Our strength, our beauty, our intelligence is all coming by Krishna's arrangement. Then the next aspect of the Supreme Lord is called Paramatma, and that's what we're talking about today. So Paramatma is that Krishna actually loves us so much that Krishna never leaves us even for a moment. And so Krishna, he not only does he enter within every atom, as it's being described here today, but he enters into everyone's heart. And the example that's given in the Bhagavad Gita is of two birds within a tree, and one bird is eating the fruits of the tree, and the other bird is witnessing that bird. So the same way, the Paramatma is witnessing our actions. And we are performing activities either according to the modes of material nature or out of loving devotion to Krishna. You see? So, two points are made. One point is that we should understand that everything we're doing is witnessed. You see, someone might doubt, well, you know, nobody is witnessing me doing bad actions. So, you know, how can you say that I'm getting reactions for that? You know, just like a criminal. If a criminal's not caught, you know, they're not punished. But because of the presence of the super soul, all of our actions, our thoughts, all of our desires, everything are being witnessed. And not that Krishna wants to kind of pry into our lives. In fact, Krishna remains silent unless we turn to him. But Krishna, he remains with us because he loves us and he tries to help us to, you know, improve ourselves and to actually experience real happiness. So just like, you know, so many times parents experience this, right? Like the child will want to do something that the parents know is injurious, right? So it's not that the parents are there to, you know, impede the child's happiness, but the parents are there witnessing the child and taking care of the child out of love for the child, right? You don't want a child to pick up a gun and start playing with a pistol or a knife or fire or poison or a vicious animal, right? The parent, you know, and in fact, you know, that's a type of education system that's been introduced in America, and it's been furthered by modern day psychologists, and they've even termed it child psychology, and they've called it the child independence. And what they're saying is that if a child is allowed to do whatever they like, whenever they like, the child does not develop the mental and intellectual civilities or civil, like the word civil, They don't develop the mental restrictions that keep them from actually experiencing, unrestricted enjoyment. And they go so far as to even advocate, parents engaging in oral sex with their children at the earliest possible age, and it even gets more vulgar and strange, all in the name of allowing your child to experience enjoyment, right? And this is not at all true. To help a child to understand, particular perimeters and also what's injurious and what's beneficial to them, is for their well-being. The parents do that out of love for their children. If you just say, there's a poisonous snake out in the yard, honey. Go play with it, baby. Come on. Enjoy yourself. Right? It doesn't matter if the snake bites you. That's okay. That's life. You see what I mean? It's a type of insanity. But, and if you look at practical examples, let's just say, for example, following traffic laws, right? So we all stop at the red light. We all go at the green light, right? We all follow a particular speed limit. And in doing that, we can actually travel harmoniously together and enjoy our lives and do things. If we violate the traffic laws, there's every chance that we're going to, injure ourselves and others. Right? So, particular laws and regulations, they actually facilitate our independence and enjoyment. You see that point? See, now, and beyond that, this point about Paramatma, see, is the form of Krishna who appears within everyone's heart. And Paramatma interacts with us solely on the principle of pure love. So even though Krishna, that's all Krishna does. That's all Krishna is interested in. That's all God is inspired by, is a loving relationship. Even if we are ignoring Krishna or denying that relationship, Krishna still interacts with us out of love, right? He's still providing us everything, even though we may just even deny God's existence, right? We have so many intellectuals that, deny God's existence. I went to this, meeting on creationism at the University of Texas in Austin years ago with one of our priests, one of our sannyasis, His Holiness Gunagrari Maharaj. And there were about a dozen leading professors, in the field that were studying creationism. And there was one in particular who was leading the discussion. And there were about maybe 200 students and us, and a few administrators there, So this particular professor, I've told this story before, but it's just so shocking. So this professor was there, and in those days they allowed you to smoke in public buildings, which is just hellish, But this professor's there with the big, glass ashtray, right? Just smoking the cigarette after cigarette, just like so annoying. And, but finally, at the end of the whole thing, his presentation, Gunagrari Maharaj raises his hand and he said, I'd like to ask a question. He said, I may not have done my homework, meaning Maharaj, because everything's couched in this very, intellectual rhetoric. But actually what they're talking about is very basic. They kind of block. Normal people from actually evaluating them by overly intellectualizing and using rhetoric that we're not familiar with. Which to me is the downfall of an educator. Hare Krishna, good morning. To me, that's the downfall of education. If you don't allow your students and your audience to understand what you're presenting, then what value does it have, you know? But, you know, that's another discussion. But basically, our modern-day intellectuals have, you know, put themselves in competition with one another because the whole educational, you know, institution is no longer based in education. It's based as a business, right? The classical Indian education system was, whether you came from a poor man's family or a king's family, you went to the teachers, you were trained, and then according to your means, you would give the teacher what was called guru dakshin, a donation, you know, to facilitate them. But nowadays, so whether you could pay a lot or not, the teacher took their position as subservient to God, realizing that God is my maintainer, not the king or not some other business arrangement, but actually it's Krishna that's providing everything. So if I perform my duty correctly, Krishna will arrange, you know, the king will be happy, my princes, everyone will be happy, and they'll naturally, the educator will be taken care of very well, even better than they probably would have asked for, right? So, but, you know, in our present-day system, if even a girl or boy, you know, they could be extremely brilliant, but they're forced out of school if they can't pay the tuition. You know, they could be leading, you know, the education system and all types of beneficial development, but if they can't pay the tuition, I'm sorry, you have to leave. Even like major education institutions like the University of California in Santa Cruz, which is an extremely wealthy community, but somehow because the state of California mismanaged their tax money, the state went bankrupt, and because of that, the university in Santa Cruz had to raise their tuition within 1 year by 45%. Now tell me, who can manage that? Or young people going into an education system thinking that by the time I graduate, I'm going to be at least $100,000 to $200,000 in debt. You know, how are young people supposed to survive? We're supposed to have the best facilities, the best communication, the best, you know, infrastructure. Then if that's true, why hasn't the price come down? That means that people who are running these institutions want to make more and more money. So the real thing is, it's not an educational institution, it's a business to make money. So let's, you know, let's call apples apples and orange oranges. You know? Textbooks scams. Yeah, see, that's a perfect example. You know, here you are, you're going to college, you're forced to take a starter course. In other words, they are demanding you to study things that you're not even interested in, that you're not even going to use, that aren't even, you know, connected to your particular field. But yet, no, it's required. So, and not only that, so you have to pay $300 for the class that you don't need. You have to buy all the textbooks, which are like $100 a pop nowadays. And then on top of it, the instructor is an author, and then he is throwing on top of it, you know, the condition that you have to now buy all of his textbooks, you know, that he's written. So, you know, what are we supposed to do? And then you have to get an access code. You can't buy them at half price books, and you got to pay an extra $100 for an access code. Yeah, see, so that's all. It's all business, and it's not even nice business. It's manipulative, and it's not in all consideration. There's no consideration for the well-being of the student or the student's family. You know, you imagine, here you are, you enroll your kids and, you know, University of California in Santa Cruz, you know, I'm sure, you know, even before it went up 45%, you know, it wasn't cheap, right? So here you are, you know, how, honey, how are we going to be able to pay for this, you know, and on top of it, the dormitory, food, all of that, right? So you're already stretching yourself to the limit. And then, hey, next year, you got a 45%, you know, increase. So, oh, it was 20. Don't worry. Now it's only 38%, you know, or $38,000 for this semester. Well, where are you supposed to get the money from? That's your problem. And if you don't, you know, and then if you go, then, and if you try to enroll in another university, right? Then it's this whole thing about transferring credits and will they accept it because it's a different school and blah, 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 you know. It's a tremendous amount of manipulation and exploitation, you know. It's all really white collar criminality. It's so-called legal crime. So, you know, the traditional education system that we see here is not at all based like that. You know, Prabhupada himself, he never charged for his classes. He never charged in the temples. Yeah, when we go out, if we're going to do something, we'll charge. Because we don't want people to take this cheaply. And we do need money to conduct these affairs. So when we go outside, we charge. But in the temple, our courses are free. And another thing is, see, Vedic knowledge is actually helping us to bring out what's already within us. You see, it's not like memorizing a bunch of information that, you know, to give it a definition. What's happening more and more today is we're being forced to learn so much about so little. See, education is actually meant to allow us to become independent, to run our own businesses, to run our own schools, to do, you know, to be independently supported through our education and our work. Not that we should be forced to be educated in a particular field that's, you know, some type of industry, right? That forces you to no longer be independent, but to become fully dependent on getting a job. Prabhupada called it unemployment and the educated dog. See, the example is that, especially in the city, a stray dog will go from house to house looking for a master, someone to take care of the dog, right? And if the dog doesn't find anyone, the dog will starve. So the dog will come to your house, right? And the dog will behave very nicely and look at you and with the big eyes and wag its tail and, you know, hope that you will take the dog in. See? So in the same way, this modern education system, so-called education system, actually this modern business that's going on in the name of education, it's forcing students to come out of school and then go from company to company. They might have 17 degrees in a particular field, but if they don't get a job, they'll starve. So they go to from company to company, will you give me a job? Will you give me a job? I'll do whatever you say. I'll work as many hours as you want. I'll work on, what's that? Rather than getting your hourly salary, they just give you a certain amount. Commission? No, that there's more than that. It's there's an agreement you sign, and no matter how many hours you have to work, you'll only be paid a certain amount of money. And so then what they do is they give you projects that require you to with a deadline that requires you to work so much overtime, but you've signed an agreement that you'll only be paid so much money. So initially it seems like, yeah, you know, I don't have a job, I have all these loans I have to pay, and on top of it I have to support myself, right? So we make these agreements, and then the result of it is exploitation. And then as soon as you're a little outdated, they fire you. You're laid off. It's happening to so many young people, you know? They get into these fields. I had a friend who You know, he was really smart. He did great in school. He went into computer science. And by the time he had his kids, he was outdated. So he had to go to school. He had to study in the morning, work all day, and then study at night to keep updated. And then as soon as his pay level got to a certain point, like where he was making, you know, he got up to like 6-digit income, they laid him off. And then they hire a bunch of new people that are up to date for, you know, 1/4 of what they were paying him. And it's all done, you know, in a very polished and bureaucratic way. You almost, today, you don't even know who's hiring you. You know, you fill out an application online, you go for an interview, you know, a group of people involved in the interview, but nobody really owns the company, nobody's really the decision maker, and then that information is privately passed on through some bureaucratic system. The same thing with the government. Like when I was a kid, local government was empowered. The way it was set up, the way it was running, was the federal government oversaw and facilitated state government, and state government facilitated the local government. Because otherwise, how can it operate? You know, how can a guy sitting in Washington, D.C. in his office, I don't care how many advisors he's got and how, you know, well educated he is, that guy cannot see what's going on in this neighborhood. He doesn't know about the old lady who's down here whose parents, you know, whose husband died 15 years ago and who, you know, doesn't even have, you know, the strength or ability to cut her yard or paint her house. He doesn't know about the broken streets out here. He doesn't know about the college students that are struggling to pay their tuitions. You know what I mean? The local government, you know, like a local board, you know, knows, hey, we know your family. We know what's going on. You know, we know what you guys need. You see? And then the whole thing was so much more friendly and uplifting and practical. It was personal. Yeah, I just don't look at it, so I don't care. I'm not affected by it. Yeah. So, you see, so Paramatma is actually like that person who cares in the local government, who knows you and who helps you. So Paramatma loves us so much that Paramatma will facilitate our material desires. But Paramatma also, because Paramatma doesn't interfere with our independence. Because if God interfered with our independence, there would be no love. If God just forced us to be all good, right, and to always decide everything in terms of loving God and loving one another, there would be no independence, that without that independence, there would be no real love. You see? So, if we're very intelligent, we learn by hearing this. And then we start to do the right thing, and we become naturally happy, and our relationships have become based on love and devotion for one another, which is the most attractive feature of life. You know? Not somebody controlling us and telling us what to do. Nobody likes that. So God doesn't do that. You see that? So Paramatma. So someone might say, well, I don't see Paramatma, so I don't believe in Paramatma, right? Well, you know, we talked about it the other day. You know, you might not see the law of gravity, but if you go up on this building and jump off, it still works. So whether or not you believe that something's in control, you see, is not really a belief, but there is a factual, you know, perception. You know, it's just like, for example, right now, according to modern science, our planet is flying through outer space at the speed of 1,600 miles per hour. 1,600 miles per hour. It's pretty smooth, isn't it? I mean, this is smoother than riding in a, you know, a fantastic, you know, limousine or whatever, you know. I mean, we're traveling at over almost 2,000 miles per hour right now. We're not being blown off the planet by 2,000 mile per hour winds. we're not feeling any rumbling or any kind of discomfort, right? Now you want to tell me that that's just happening by chance? I mean, is that really what you believe? And what they say is if we moved an inch closer to the sun, we'd burn to death, or an inch farther away from the sun, we'd freeze to death. So this planet is traveling at 1,600 miles per hour. You know, within 1 inch, you know, orbit, within a pathway that is so concise that it's calculated down to the inch, a planet. We're not talking about a golf ball, you know. And this orbit and this whole arrangement is just nobody in control of it. Nothing's in control. It happened by an explosion. You see, I mean, that's really that's the extent of modern education. They're willing to actually broadcast that and inculcate modern youth with that. When I was a kid, education wasn't like that. It was in God we trust. Man, we said a prayer every morning in school. But, you know, people have become so dull-headed because of gross sensual exploitation, you know, for their own bodies and the bodies of others. They're so dull-headed that they can't, it just comes down to, you know, a struggle for existence, you know. Whatever I am, I could sure use some money, right? We were talking about that. Oh, you need money? Oh, great. Don't worry. We have this wonderful master's, you know, course in post-industrial life. You know, we're going to get you to add to the, you know, 95% of all the useless things that are destroying the environment and that are being sold in the shopping malls and online right now. You know, let's face it, you go into a shopping mall, 95% of the things that are there, you don't even need it. I went Christmas shopping with my wife like 2 years ago, and we walked through the mall, and my wife said, "Look it, I don't need any of this. We have everything in our home already." So what my wife said is, "Hey, what if we celebrate Christmas by saving money?" So, you know, people become indifferent to the idea of God's existence primarily because of deep-rooted exploitative intention. We are thinking that I'm exploiting everyone, and everyone else is exploiting me. So personal relationships don't work. In fact, you'll find even spiritual philosophies where the idea is that you should annihilate your existence, and become void. That's the actual meaning of the word nirvana. In Buddhism, it's really interesting, Lord Chaitanya in the Chaitanya Charitamrita, he meets with the leading Buddhist monk of India 500 years ago. And he basically, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu shows and stops Buddhism within India for a number of reasons. And it's quite unique because Buddha is one of the 10 main incarnations of Krishna. So, but you have to see everything in its proper, you know, perspective and context. See, Buddha appeared because people were violating the Vedic injunctions and they were killing animals in the name of Vedic sacrifice. So Buddha, he advocated ahimsa, nonviolence, which is another really interesting thing. You meet Buddhists today and you say, "Oh, do you meet?" "Of course." "Well, I thought the main purpose of Buddhism was to stop violence, ahimsa." "Oh yeah, we do that once a year on Buddhist birthday, you know, or something like that." But anyway, beyond modern, you know, like in the modern experience, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, he said, well, first of all, if Buddhism is an agnostic, it's actually an atheistic philosophy. And there's many reasons Buddha advocated this, but basically he was trying to draw people away from their misuse of the Vedic literature and to bring them back to at least following him. And also Buddha, at the time when he appeared, there was an influx of conditioned souls that needed to become embodied, to needed to take birth in physical bodies to live out their materialistic desires. And so Buddha advocated a more or less atheistic philosophy to allow for the conditioned souls that were deeply materialistic to take birth at that time, to accommodate a more or less atheistic and materialistic civilization. Out of love. Not that Buddha wants that, but he's tolerating us and facilitating us. But anyway, so in Buddhism, there are 9 main principles of Buddhism. The first principle is that creation is eternal. Therefore, there is no necessity of a creator. That's atheism. Right? If something exists eternally, what question is there of there being a creator? It just exists. It's kind of like the primordial soup, right? We did a skit in here once. Yeah, you know that primordial soup. It's a Western scientific paradigm that everything came from a primordial soup. We did a skit in here once. There was a lady here, Mother Shravaniya. She had a photographic memory. She was an actress. So she dressed up as a New York-style waitress, you know, with the pink and the high heels with the cat-eye glasses and the chewing gum, right, with the pencil over the big bun. Right, and she was from New York too. She had the New York accent. It was so much fun. And I came into the table and he said, oh, welcome to my restaurant. You know, and she'd say, here's the menu. And, you know, so anyway, just to bring it to the primordial soup. So I said, oh, I asked her what her specials were, and she said, oh, we've got vegetable soup and, oh no, she said, we've got missing link soup and primordial soup. Because you heard about the missing link, right? In Darwin's theory, they talk about the missing link. Yeah, so anyway, it was missing link. It was missing link sausages and primordial soup. I said, wow, the primordial soup sounds interesting. I said, what's in it? She said, I really don't know. I said, well, could you ask the chef, you know, because I'm a vegetarian. I just want to make sure it's vegetarian. And she comes back from the kitchen. She walks in, comes back, and she says, well, I asked the chef. He doesn't know either. I said, well, somebody must make it. Where does it come from? She said, he just comes in every morning and it's there. She said, but the kids from the college eat up the whole batch every lunch rush. Anyway, I'm bringing up primordial soup and because that's more or less the foundation of Buddhism. They're saying that creation exists eternally, therefore there is no necessity of a creator. But what we're saying is that everything we experience has a beginning, a middle, and an end. Therefore, if something has a beginning, it must have a creator to initiate its manifestation. But without going through all the principles, in conclusion, Buddhism recommend the goal of Buddhism is nirvana. Nirvana literally means to annihilate one's existence. And the strict Buddhist monks, they'll practice things like meditating on one hand clapping within a dark room, you know, to stop all desire, to stop all sense of, you know, personal existence, to come to a state of total desirelessness where you merge and enter into a state of complete void. And like here in Dallas, they have this Buddhist Enlightenment Center. There's an actress who comes here, God, I can't remember her name right now. But she, her friend, he's like a famous businessman. He started the place. And she told me what they do is they have these jacuzzi bathtubs and they fill them up with a salt. So you float in it like the Dead Sea. And they have people go in there. They pay $400 for a 45-minute session. You go, they strip you naked. They have you float in this jacuzzi bathtub, right? And they cover you in a dark box. In total darkness, floating in this water, you know, to end all desire, to end your personal existence, right? At $400 a session. I said, yeah. I can't remember her name right now. Oh, God, what is it? She's such a nice lady. I said, yeah, but what happens after the 45 minutes and they take the box off? You run right out of there with all your desires and your personality, right? And go buy, you know, 25 ice cream cones or whatever. You know what I mean? So what happened to your, you know, annihilation of existence and your ending of all desire? So, but Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's point was that if you're saying that creation is eternal and the goal of your practice is annihilation, how can annihilation and eternality exist side by side? It's a self-defeating philosophy. But nobody thinks about that. Nobody ventures into that. Why? Because we're so caught up in sense gratification. Hey, Hare Krishna, Manasi. New baby. Cute. So Paramatma is experienced by us each and every day. Even for someone that's not practicing spiritual life, if we just study the movements of our intelligence, we can see that there is a higher consciousness that's guiding us and helping us to fulfill our desires. Just like when we're driving, right? So you're driving. Like me, I used to be part of a racing team, so God, I hate to say it, but I'm such an aggressive driver. You know, so the kind of messages I get from Paramatma are like, hey, Narottam, don't you remember that speed trap that was up ahead? Hey, slow down. You know, when I first joined the traveling Sankirtan party, I saw I was one of the drivers, right? So my spiritual master, he told me, you know, Krishna is always with you when you're traveling on Sankirtan until you reach 75 miles per hour. After that, he jumps out of the car. But the point I'm making is that we all experience a higher consciousness helping us to facilitate our desires. You know, you read all these great intellectuals, Einstein, Edison, you know, the light bulb coming on and all of that. You know, for years he was doing all these scientific experiments. And then he said at one point it was just revealed to him exactly what he needed to do from a higher transcendental intervention. And we all experience that every day. So Paramatma is there, guiding us, helping us, and out of love for us, which is the coolest thing. So it's described here that if we meditate on Paramatma, because Paramatma is within all the atoms, see, because everything is coming from God, when we meditate on God's powers, his particular aspects, like here, that God can enter within this, become the smallest of the smallest. God can enter within the atom. That a person who actually becomes advanced in that meditation, they actually acquire that potency from the Lord. And they, as it's described here, they can enter into even stone. And there's a beautiful history of the eagle carrier here in the back of the temple, Garuda. So he gained that mystic power, and he was able to take away what in English is known as the elixir of immortality from the denizens of heaven, and he supplied that to out of an arrangement to free his mother from a lifetime enslavement. His mother was a queen, and she had a sister who was also a queen. And at the time when they churned the ocean of milk, there was a huge universal arrangement, and they churned, there's an ocean of milk in the higher planetary systems to create this elixir of immortality. So, but while they were doing that, from the ocean of milk, many things appeared, like the goddess Lakshmi. But one of the things that appeared was this divine horse named Uchaishrava. So they wagered that this horse has appeared. They heard about it through the, you know, celestial news. And so they wagered to one another that, tell me, my dear sister, how you think this celestial, you know, mirror must look, right? And then I will tell you how I think it's described. And then we will go there, and whoever's description is correct, the other will become the lifetime slave. So the one who made the wager, she's considered to be the forefather of the race, the foremother of the race of snakes. So after her sister left, she told these serpents, go there, go to that celestial horse and hang from its tail and make its tail look pure black. Because she said, her sister said, the horse must be pure white. And she, and then the other sister said, no, it must be pure white with jet black tail. So she told the snakes, go and hang from the tail, and tomorrow we'll go there and see, and I will win the wager. And she became this lifetime slave of her sister. So Garuda, he penetrated through this incredible, it's a gigantic war that he wagered against the denizens of heaven. But finally, in the inner sanctum where this elixir of immortality was kept, there were, it's described that there were these gigantic wheels, razor sharp wheels. And they had a spoke system in the center. And the wheels would encircle the elixir of immortality at the speed of the mind. They would go around in circles, like, around the room. Anyone who would enter in there that didn't know the mystic mantras to stop those wheels would just be cut in shreds. So Garuda went there using this anima potency by meditating on the Lord within his heart, Paramatma, and he shrunk his form down so small, and he shattered through the spokes of the wheel and dismantled the system. And then there's other things there that were put there to stop him, but he was able to defeat everything, and he took the elixir of immortality, and he brought that to free his mother completely as a selfless act. And because of that, the Paramatma, Vishnu, appeared to Garuda. And he blessed Garuda that you may become immortal and never die, even without drinking this elixir of immortality. And then Garuda, he didn't know who Vishnu was at first, and so but he's extremely powerful, so he offered a benediction to the Lord, and then he said to the Lord that, may I always, he becomes the carrier of Lord Vishnu. He offers this really beautiful benediction to Lord Vishnu. And Lord Vishnu accepts him as his winged carrier. That's why the deity of Garuda is always present within the temple. Yeah, I like that. So, yeah, this anima potency. But it's really interesting, and I'll conclude the class, is that there was a German disciple of Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati, Prabhupada's spiritual master, who went to India and in search of a bona fide spiritual master. So he went to these yogis, and the yogis were talking about this anima potency to be able to enter within stone or float upon water and do different mystical feats. And this German, he was an intellectual, he was a scholar. He said, but these perfections have already been achieved by Western science. that Western science can penetrate within a mountain and go inside a stone. They can, with boats and hovercrafts and all these things, across water. With jet aircraft, they can fly within the sky. So the German disciple of Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati concluded that these things, even though they deal with a subtle science, they're still materialistic. They're still a material science. And so then he pursued, a higher understanding that something must exist beyond these mystic arts. And that's when he met Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati and began practicing Krishna consciousness. Interesting, isn't it? Okay, so I'll stop here. Thank you for your kind attention. And congratulations. Nice to see the beautiful new baby I haven't seen before. Maybe I did in the carrier, but covered up. You came before with her in the carrier. Yeah, she was covered. Radhika Priya. Oh, such a beautiful name. I love that. The dearest of Radharani. It's very nice. Yeah, I hope she becomes a great devotee of Radharani. Hare Krishna. Okay, so if you have any questions, otherwise it's breakfast time. Okay, great. All right, so I hope everyone has a great day today. Thank you so much, and all glories to Srila Prabhupada. Hare Krishna.